You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 464.
If it can be written or thought, it can be filmed. Stanley Kubrick.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success.
The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's film, B-I-Z, book.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Well, guys, today on the show, we have the definition of a filmtrepreneur. Our guest today is Mike Dion, who is a documentary filmmaker who has made a living over the past decade applying all of the things I talk about in Rise of the Filmtrepreneur. He was doing it before I wrote the book. He's been doing it since about 2009, 2010. And what he's been able to do is he found a niche, which is extreme bicycle riding, like, you know, bicycle riding across countries and things like that, following tours and other things. And he's been able to create multiple documentaries, successful documentaries, and started to feed and service that community again and again. And he's been able to sustain himself as a filmmaker by doing that for over a decade. And I wanted to kind of pick his brain on how he's been able to do that, what he's doing, how he's selling things, what are his ancillary product lines, what's making money, what's not making money, and all those things. So this is a very educational episode, to say the least. So if you want to learn how to make money with your film, perk up those ears, because this is going to be one heck of a episode. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Mike Dion. I'd like to welcome to the show Mike Dion, man. How you doing, Mike?
Doing good, thank you.
Good, man. Thank you so much for coming on the show, man. Our mutual friend Kia Kiso, who's also a friend of the show, been on the show as well. She has been talking about you for as long as I've known her. She's like, you and Mike have to get together. You guys think alike. You got to do all this stuff. And you and I have been so busy. We've been just going back and forth trying to figure out times for us to actually do this. So we finally did this. And when I started to dig in deep into what you're doing, man, you are the personification of my book come to life. It's like you got my copy of Rise of the Filmtrepreneur and went back in time. And like, I'm going to do this before anybody does. Like, you were doing everything I talk about in Rise of the Filmtrepreneur years ago, almost a decade now ago, when it wasn't cool and it wasn't the thing to do. And self-distribution was like, are you insane? What are you doing? You were building up this mini empire business that you've built over the years. And I was just so blown away. So I needed to bring you on the show so you can share all your secrets on on how you do this so other filmmakers can follow your path. So before we get started, man, how did you get into the business?
I actually went to film school back in the day in an amazing film school at State University. You know, I'm sure we've all heard of it. Mm-hmm. So I was started off there, graduated in the early 90s. And luckily enough, there were some films being shot in Montana the year that I graduated, Far and Away. A river runs through it. And luckily enough, Professor Vars got us on set for these, you know, crazy ass films, getting to hang out with Ron Howard and Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt and Robert Redford. But I think interestingly enough, you know, kind of having this chip on your shoulder, it's like, I should be directing these films. I shouldn't be like charging walkie talkie batteries for, you know, for Ron Howard's assistant, you know?
Oh, so, I want to be a film student.
Oh my God. Yeah. I look back on that. I'm going, you silly child. So, but I think what was interesting about that is I almost got, you know, it's like, this was too big. This Hollywood stuff was too big. So it almost kind of made it okay then to go get a job with a local video production company and start doing commercials and shooting and producing and editing and everything else. So that's kind of where it all started way back in the day.
Now you, the movie that kind of launched you into this film entrepreneurial business model, if I may coin my own word, was Ride the Divide. Now, Ride the Divide, please tell people what Ride the Divide is and who is it aimed at as far as an audience is concerned.
Sure thing. Ride the Divide is a feature-length documentary film that covered an inaugural mountain bike race from Canada to Mexico, and it was centered on this cycling, ultra-endurance cycling bikepacking. And back in the day, this was kind of a very under-the-radar event. It's the antithesis to things like the Tour de France. It's the opposite of that, where it's all self-supported. There's no teams. And it wasn't really directed at anybody. It was one of those pure passion projects where here's this crazy event. We should capture it to the best of our ability and then see what happens to it. And, you know, what could have, you know, just been a YouTube video with some effort in the editing and the packaging actually became a real film that, you know, went on to do great things.
So, take me through the process, because there was no Rise of the Film Entrepreneur. There was no education. There's no information about what you're doing like there is today. So how did you come to understand like, okay, well, we've made this movie. Obviously, our audience is – one of our audiences is bikers and people who like to mountain bike and who are bike enthusiasts and cycle enthusiasts. How did you begin to put everything together? Like, wait a minute, let's target these people. And how did you target it in
early 2010 is when.
MySpace was all the rage. So there was no Facebook ads yet. Was there
no ads? Facebook existed, yeah, and Twitter, sure, existed, but yeah, weren't spending money on ads then.
Right, exactly. So there was no targeting like you could do now to find an audience and target and all that stuff. It was a lot more difficult back then. So how did you start figuring this out?
I think the mindset came, the film got into the Vail Film Festival and it, you know, actually won Best Adventure Film at the Vail Film Festival, and we packed the screening through our own efforts of putting the word out there. It's like, hey, our film is finally done. Come see it. So people traveled to Vail to come watch the film, and we sold out. There were people standing in the back of the room watching this film. And in my mind, it was like the Vail Film Festival is collecting all the ticket sales from this, and we're not getting anything. We're not Correct. Collecting any of this. So that gave me almost, it's like, well, shit, I'm going to start booking my own theaters. And one thing that, you know, being that it is sports, there was a ski film director, Warren Miller. I don't know if you ever heard of Warren Miller ski films, but he's been around forever. And I remember being a kid going and watching Warren Miller ski films in auditoriums and things like that. So he kind of had this model where take a film on tour, you know, book an auditorium or a theater, sell tickets to the passionate skiers and kind of have prizes and giveaways and, you know, have a good time. So that, you know, having that as a kid, but then wanting to, it's like, you know, monetize, collect my own ticket sales. Well, that kind of started it off. And then, you know, we booked the Boulder Theater in Boulder, Colorado, which was 860 seat theater. And we sold 550 tickets and had Gregory Alan Isakoff perform, you know, music, who was from Boulder and also had some sound songs in the film itself. So that was the beginning of what kind of kicked off. It's like, I'm taking control of this thing.
Yeah, because you did you even try to go down the traditional distribution route?
Yeah, most definitely. So we did get the film signed with New Video, which in an aggregator, which then got bought out and became Cinedigm. So Cinedigm did get us into iTunes and did get us a tiny Netflix deal, super freaking tiny Netflix deal. And it got us into the digital platforms. But then we also we're continuing the path of putting on our own events, putting our own DVDs up on Amazon and direct to consumer type mentality of sales.
So, so that was your first experience, but did you get, like, I don't say the word screwed, but it wasn't a distributor. It was an aggregator you were dealing with mostly.
Yeah. Well, yep. So they treated us pretty good for up until about year six or so, payments kind of stopped for a while. I think as they kind of transitioned from New Video to Cinedigm, payments stopped, and there was a good year and a half where payments didn't happen, but then they started making good on things. So, I haven't been royally screwed, knock on wood, by anybody yet, but we haven't really kind of gone down the path of I can recognize a shady situation perhaps and having enough belief in myself. It's like, no, I don't need you. This doesn't feel right. I'm not going to choose you.
fair enough. Now, you say that you put the word out. How did you actually start cultivating this audience?
Yeah. I think Facebook was, it was early on and Facebook and actually Twitter, we were using Twitter. But then as we would put on our own sort of theatrical screening events, we tried to the best of our ability to connect with local, bike shops and advocacy groups and partners in each city that did have potentially newsletter lists and email lists and their own fan bases. So definitely as much partnership mentality as we could do to help spread the word. And then even forums, thinking back.
Oh, yeah.
Forums were a thing.
Message boards.
Absolutely. So it was everything and everything, just kind of taking on that mentality of a PR type person.
But you were going after cyclists and fans.
Absolutely.
So you're going to message boards about cycling and bicycle enthusiasts and anything dealing with that niche, if you will, that kind of audience.
Absolutely.
And just starting to pound them as much as you could. That's something I was doing in 2005 with a little short film that was aimed at independent filmmakers to teach them how to make a low budget independent film. And I did it instinctively, kind of like you. I was just kind of figuring it out. I'm like, wait a minute. The audience is here. I've got a product for them. Maybe I should connect these guys.
These are my people. How do I present what I just created to my people?
Right, exactly. And that's amazing. So you start building it up. Did you start figuring out email yet at this point, as far as grabbing email lists? And how important is an email list to you in your business model now?
Huge, massive. Email list is freaking massive. And so we did cobble together a WordPress website. And we did start collecting emails from there, and then did get sort of a merchant sort of aspect onto this cobbled together WordPress
merchant
website.
Account. Yeah.
Yep. And it was
early on.
E-Junkie?
You use E-Junkie. I used E-Junkie. Yeah. E-Junkie.
So E-Junkie was kind of how was the merchant piece to this cobbled together WordPress site. And we'd kind of put that together. And then what was interesting, we finished the website and then I think put a link on Facebook or something, and woke up the next morning and there was like 7 DVD sales. And it's like,
isn't that amazing?
We're onto something.
Isn't that the most amazing feeling?
Yes.
Like when I did that for the first time, when I launched, cause I've been talking to my audience for months and they had trailers and people were like excited about this DVD. And the second I hit send on that email, like it was like, I don't know, to maybe like 500 people I collected over the over whatever. And I did it manually. There was no email service. It was just like a manually sending it out to people back in the day.
DCC.
And all of a sudden I would just hear PayPal emails. Ding, 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 ding. It was just the best. But then you had it. And that was the, that.
Oh my God, dude. It's like, I fulfilled everything out of this freaking house for the last 10 years. It's, you know, our garage has been filled with boxes at times. But you know,
that's the game.
I don't know. It's that, game. That is the game. And, you know, because I'm fulfilling everything, I also get on a postcard to write a little thank you note, you know, John, thank you, !! Mike Dion, put it in the package. So, you know, 98% of everything I've shipped out of here, people have got a little, you know, signed thank you card for me, you know, over the last 10 years. So it's that, I think it's that kind of mentality and strategy and thinking and caring about an audience. If someone's going to go through the effort of whipping out a credit card and sending you, you know, money, should we not be appreciative for that?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Because a lot of times, you know, filmmakers a lot of times think of it as almost transactional, and it's not really grassroots. It's not really building a community. And it's because, look, it's daunting to build a community. It's daunting, and it's time consuming. You know this as well as I do. It takes years to build a passionate community. You have to provide a tremendous amount of value. You have to give them what they're looking for. It takes time. It takes time. But I think you could attest to this. Once that audience is built and that relationship is solid, you can build upon that and continue to make new products and new films. And that's what you've kind of done.
Yeah. It's to use e-commerce type, and you know, it's customer lifetime value. So by putting in the effort of building a customer, and or a fan, you've now then, you know, have this customer lifetime value where if you do then have a new project and you want to send an email list, hey, here's my next Kickstarter, you hit send, and within 10 days, there's $25,000, you know,
right,
because in an account because of, you know, of that effort that you just said you put into that audience building.
And then also you were doing films in this niche because you just truly love this niche. Like you didn't do this, like all the money's in biking movies.
Like, no, it's not like we should, you know, horror films are doing pretty good. Let's go make a horror film. It's like no one ever said there's great money in bikepacking films. Let's go make a bikepacking documentary. Said no one ever.
Right. But once you figured out, but this is something you truly enjoy, and you've been able to figure out how to monetize this for not just a year or two, or not for one project or two, you've built an essentially a business, a full blown business around this, right?
Yeah. And when you say monetize, it's, you know, it's really just creating products for these particular people and then making the products available to them. And the products just happen to be a film, a t-shirt, a poster, an experience, a how-to piece of content. So, you know, I think we go into too much strategy of what's the hot commodity right now? It's like, no, if you were to go create a product, what would the product be that you enjoy putting out to your audience?
And that's the thing that filmmakers don't get is like, they'll just, cause it's art, and I get it. Sometimes it's art, but if art, it's an expensive art form. So if you're going to do something that's expensive, you really need to fit, or that's going to take a year of your life. If you want to get paid for that in some way, shape or form, even if it is art, you really need to go, who's going to watch this? And that question is rarely asked, I find, with independent films in general. They're like, who is this targeting? Who is this aimed at? Who's going to watch this?
Yeah, I often think of this like as a startup. You know, like to have a startup mentality, I'm going to go create a SaaS product, or I'm going to go, you know, create some consumer, you know, packaged good. You know, I almost kind of take on the thought process of I'm creating, you know, if this is a startup, if this film is a startup, exactly to your point, who's the audience? How is it packaged? How are we, you know, what's the sales mechanism, you know, for this? How are we going to continue to create customers for this particular product? You know, I think from films, we get into this release, launch, work for 3 months, and then it kind of dies. But if you've got a nutrition bar, if that's your product, are you going to market that for 3 months? And then it's like, well, that was you know, the end of my promotion for this awesome nutrition bar I just made. No, you're going to continue daily, weekly basis for years upon years upon years marketing your product. So,
yeah. And that's the thing that films, you're right. Cause films that like, they think there's a shelf life. A lot of times films, and sometimes there might be a shelf life. Like, oh, that came out in 2019. I can't watch that. If the pandemic has taught us anything, I've gone back to movies I watched there 2001, 2002. I've gone back and watched old series that I don't remember anymore and started watching those again. There is no shelf life. And by the way, ask any of the studios if there's a shelf life to their libraries. Are you kidding me? You know, I mean, Spielberg still makes $5 million a year. He said, I think I heard somewhere $5 million a year off of Jaws residuals.
I get it. But it's a great story is going to have a shelf life forever. And I'm not sure if you're familiar. I don't read a whole lot of books, but there's a book, Perennial Seller by Ryan Holiday.
Oh, I know, right? Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I know Ryan Holiday. So, yeah, he's excellent. So,
Perennial Seller is the idea of if you're going to put the time and energy into creating a piece of art, whether it happens to be a painting or a book or a film or music, put in the extra energy and effort to make it a story that's got staying power, that you're going to surprise and delight the world with this piece of art that you put all this extra thought and energy into. And because it now does rise above and has potential staying power, it becomes something that you can continue to market to 7 billion people in the world. No one's ever going to, you know, fully know your piece of art. So on it, you can continue to market it for your entire life and still not reach every potential person who could appreciate watching it or seeing it or hearing it.
Right. And if you can figure out a way to automate that process, like with the, cause the website's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 a year. So it's not like you have a lemonade stand that you have to close up after a certain time. If you figure out a way to automate that, meaning like you put out content into the world that they click on and like, oh, there's this, or I watched this video. Oh, look, there's a link to the movie. If you're able to automate that, that's where you start really getting into passive income and really start building that stuff. I've built my entire business around that. Like I've built this universe of Indie Film Hustle and Bulletproof Screenwriting and all these other companies around this model of this ecosystem that I've created. And it's constantly working for me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And not only am I being able to get money from it, but I'm helping people. I'm educating people. I'm helping them on their journeys. My books, and I'm assuming the same thing with your movies. They just every day I check, there's someone bought a book. So somewhere in the world, someone bought a book. It's an audiobook, ebook, and it's constant. And when I got into the book publishing game with my first two books, oh man, I was just like, wow, this is awesome. It just, and books are one of those things that they just go. Books just, you could find a book from 20 years ago. And if it's, as long as it's still relevant information, I mean, look, what is it? Napoleon Hill. You know, I mean, Jesus, you know, I mean, those kind of self-help books and things, they just go on and on and on. So do you have that same kind of?
Yeah, absolutely. But you say automation, but I wouldn't, you know, let people think automation is easy, right? So
no.
it is easy after the fact, but
yes.
Once you've put the time and energy in creating the gears of the machine that once built, then become a flywheel that have continued motion. So, you know, what does automation look like? It's website, it's SEO, it's putting out YouTube videos
with articles,
SEO and content and links. And it is building Facebook content, Instagram content, and it is putting email automations in place when people do. So, but once you've put that system in place, then yes, it does have automatic
yes,
situation to it.
But it takes a while. It takes years sometimes to put that together.
But that's strategy, right? But if you've got that mentality back again, this is my startup. This is my product. This is my sales mechanism that I'm putting in place. And then once it's in place, 80% of it is automation. And now the 20% that you're kind of putting, continuing to feed the machine on a daily or weekly basis becomes easier.
Right. And like what you've done, because you had Ride the Divide, but then to continue to feed that beast, you did Inspire to Ride. You did Reveal the Path, which were all like, not sequels, but they definitely all go together in a nice package, which of course you could sell as a package. but you kept feeding that beast over the years, as well as we'll get into all the product lines and other things that you were built up. But just on the movie standpoint, you kept feeding into this audience and you kept giving them new, fresh content, right?
Correct. Yep. That's right. So for a good, from 2010 to about 2018, it was exactly as you just described. That was the full-time job, really, putting out films and content and marketing. And then 2018 or so, one of the main characters in my film Inspired to Ride was killed in a cycling event, and that not only threw me back, but kind of the whole community. So that put a wrench in things for a few years, and it kind of reassessed some things and did a lot more sort of freelance work and contract work. So, but now it's kind of coming back into the swing of things again, and with new ideas. So
right, exactly.
For this audience, but new distribution media company type ideas.
That's excellent. Now, when you were releasing your films, did you do a theatrical or self-theatrical runs on this stuff?
Yes, every single one. And when the films first came out, we would do a good 20 to 30 city tour with the film, mostly in the Western states. I'm in Colorado, and a lot of cyclists between the Rocky Mountains and West. So I'd go kind of hit a theatrical tour for 6 weeks or so, and then kind of made it available where bike shops and other entities could put on their own theatrical screenings, and then almost hired a tour promoter to kind of put on shows and stuff like that. We kind of a little secret weapon with that. So
now, did you do four-walling, or did you actually get booked?
The bulk of it was four-walling. Yep. And then there was some split ticket sale splits happening as well. But the bulk of it was four-walling. Yep.
Okay. And then, did you sell products at those screenings?
Most definitely. That was key. So definitely merch table setup, DVDs, posters, t-shirts, all set up with the merch table, signing posters. And then also, to the best of our ability, collecting email addresses. If we were selling our own tickets through something like brown paper tickets or right. Eventbrite or something like that, well, we then had the email address. And I even kind of for the last film, when it was out there, I actually kind of had a little preview that was me welcoming people to the screening event and saying, hey, whip out your cell phone right now. I know, which is weird because, yes, it's dark and no one should, whip out their phone. But hey, I want you to text, the word Inspired Film to, I forget what the number was, 444-222. And I'm going to select some winners from that. So, that actually was a killer strategy, because then, not only did I get people's phone numbers, but then they entered their email address within this. And then as the film went on to some film festivals, and then I mentioned we kind of had a tour promoter that kind of took the film out on his own. So I'd be sitting at home and all of a sudden my phone would just like go off with, 60 text messages, when he had the film out there, and then, that played. And then I waited about 90 minutes until the film was done. And then I started texting people back. Hey, this is Mike, the director. Hope you enjoyed the film. And people would lose their minds. It's like, dude, that was awesome. I loved it. Thank you. So, just unique strategies, right? Having fun with this whole game.
Now, you talked a little bit about hosting your own screenings. How did you do well with those host your own screenings?
Some of them would break even. Some of them, made thousands. Some of them made hundreds. Some of them lost $100. But what I, the goodwill and, creating a fan and having that face-to-face communication, and then having them potentially go tell a few people. And then if we do, you know, again, your earlier question about an email list, well, now I haven't, you know, to be able to, if I lost money, I now have 70 emails that over the next 5 years, I likely generated thousands and thousands of dollars from those 70 people who showed up at a screening earlier on. So that's kind of how I see that.
So yeah, if you get 70 people to come up to a screening for a documentary about bike riding, they're pretty passionate, targeted people. They are more than likely the percentage, I'd imagine, of them purchasing another product or watching another movie or renting something else you did. It's very high, because that's a hot.
And that was
prospect
on the low end. I'd say 70 was the, you know, between 70 and 250 is generally the screenings were.
And that's worth the price of admission. If you broke even, you're winning. If you lose $100, you're winning. You know, unless it was
if you've got that lifetime value
infrastructure
mentality.
And also infrastructure in place.
Yeah.
If you have the infrastructure in place to take advantage of that kind of opportunity to better serve that potential customer, all the better. Absolutely. I was always wondering about those host the screening things, but and I also saw that you sold credits to your film. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah.
A little bit here and there for like $25 or something like that, which is, you want your name in the movie credits? $25. It was like, did that do anything? Did you make any money with that?
Inspired to Ride's Kickstarter, we did that. And then with this new thing we're doing now, you know, as we're editing this new thing, I've kind of got a founding member sort of thing happening where, yeah, you do get your name in the credits and you get to win the actual camera that shot the original Ride the Divide. And we haven't talked about what RTD 10 is, but I think if you do it in a cool way, then yes, I think it's cool.
it's a cool thing, but it's also, it builds your community. It builds the audience. It builds the niche. And you're connecting with them. Like they really are invested in you, because now my name is on that movie. So now you've created a much more even passionate
right. Especially, audience. You know, knowing that these films are on iTunes and these bigger platforms. Well, then it becomes bragging rights. It's like, dude, come over. We'll watch this. You'll see my name go by in the credit roll.
I think as filmmakers, we forget the power of a credit, because we can just type in our own names because we made the movie. So it's not that big of a deal for us, but for as we like to call them, normies, because we're carnival folk. We're carnival folk.
Yeah.
We are carnival folk. There's no question about it. But normies, they would lose their mind. They're like, oh my God, if they imagine being in a theater and seeing your name pop up for the first time. Oh my God, that would be massive. So, and if you sell them for $25 a pop, why not? It's like, or whatever the price is, but still it's a great, great strategy.
Yeah. And there's sort of packages where, yeah. And as we're kind of working on this RTD 10, it's, you could also, you know, with the movie poster, we're creating a new movie poster, you know, again, selling an associate producer or a producer credit, which, you know, so many, how many producers, you know, buy their way into the credits anyway. So,
well, there's that too. So yeah, there's, you know, when I was making films, sometimes you'll see like 6-7 executive producers, or produced by credits, because they like, well, he gave me the grip truck and, you know, he brought the cameras. So I didn't have to pay for that for the shoot. So, you know, you do what you got to do at the beginning. Like when you're coming up, you just do, you know, you do whatever you can. And sometimes it's still, even as you're going, you know, if you can sell an executive producer credit for $5,000, that takes me 2 minutes. That's more than any attorney on the planet.
Yeah. It's, again, if you look at this as a game, you know, a carny game, right, or whatever, it's, you know, you get you know, hey, step right up. Do what you got to do.
No, we didn't. Look, as filmmakers, we all got to hustle and do whatever we can. But at the end of the day, we're providing that person who buys a credited experience and bragging rights and an IMDb credit. And there's value to that. And I remember I think originally, when I was first starting, I might have bought like an associate producer credit for like $20. I was like, yes, I have an IMDb credit. That's awesome. But everybody, that was like 2000 or 96, I think it was, or 97 or whatever it was when I did it. But yeah, it's a thrill when, especially when you're just starting out or you just want that little shiny executive producer credit on there as well. And there's different packages too. You could sell like premiere tickets and other things like that as well, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So it's again, how can you surprise and delight your audience with whether it be a credit or a unique piece of merchandise or a bundle or a signed movie poster or whatever. So again, I utilize the indie music industry, you know, as a lot, you know, from examples, and I kind of steal, I'm kind of like a sponge. It's like, what industry can I steal ideas from that work with what I'm kind of doing at the moment? And, you know, I think, you know, traveling musicians, putting on tours and selling merchandise and putting bundles together and packages together. So I think as much as we can look out into other industries, and I mentioned, you know, software as a service. You're like, what ideas can you get from the SaaS startup company that you could utilize as a filmmaker and strategy and marketing? So be open to getting outside of this little bubble of like, I hope I get into a film festival and someone discovers me. It's like, screw that.
No, you've got to, in today's world, is because it's so much harder to make. I mean, even when you were starting out in 2010 and when I was coming up in 2005 with selling stuff, it was easier to make money. Like, you know, I sold thousands of DVDs back then. Now it's so much harder to generate revenue because the audience is more, there's so much more competition. These platforms are taking a whole bunch of, we'll get into the platforms in a minute. But it's just harder. The more you can control multiple revenue streams outside of the standard distribution model, which is what you've done, the better you, because if sales go down at the DVD, but the t-shirts are killing it because they just happen to be really cool t-shirts, all the better.
And what's to say, you know, 3 years later, you can't drop a new t-shirt just like a band would, you know, here's our new, you know, designs, here's three new designs. And then you even go to Facebook and Instagram. It's like, hey, here's five concepts, pick, you know, which are your favorite. And then it becomes community engagement. And then, you know, your audience picked the two winners. And now you go produce those and you're documenting that whole process. You're in the ink printing, you know, facility, videotaping them, making it, they're now available, you know, and then throughout that whole process, you've got them for sale for pre-order up on the website. So you've already probably maybe sold $4,000 or $5,000 as they're being made. And then once they're made, then you're documenting the shipping out, which generates just more buzz and more interest. So
Mike, you're talking dirty to me. Stop it. Just stop it. Stop it. Pre-orders, packing, stop it. It's just dirty talk, sir. It's so wonderful to talk to someone who gets it. Like it's just such a wonderful experience. I'm assuming it's the same for you because there's not many people you can actually have a conversation about this with.
This is, you know, like people say, are you a passionate filmmaker? I appreciate the art and the steps of, yeah, we documentary filmmakers, we wear a lot of the hats. We're shooting, we're editing, we're everything else. But the strategy of and marketing, dude, that, to your point, it's like, oh, stop talking. You know, that's exciting to me. It's like, I don't know, let's try it. Let's see if it works.
Exactly. And that's what always gets me excited as well. I mean, I'm an artist, I'm a filmmaker. I love doing that. But I also love the business side. I also love the marketing side. I also love being able to think about how to put it all together. And for me, that gets me really, really excited. Most filmmakers are just like, I just want to make a movie.
Right. But it's like, that marketing stuff is dirty. I'm a director. I just want to direct. I just want to go from film to film and direct. And that's awesome. That's great.
If you could do it, and I promise you that's 2% of the entire industry that gets to do that as like just go and direct and not think about anything else and someone else handles it. Those days are gone. And there's a small, maybe 2 to 5% of all directors trying to direct a movie in the world get that privilege. And I've spoken to many of those directors on the show who have those. And even they, and I promise you, Mike, the bigger the guy or gal that I talk to, they all still have to hustle to get the next project. It's so fascinating. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day and we were talking about Spielberg. And I'm like, yeah, Spielberg couldn't get money for Lincoln. He had to go hustle his money for Lincoln. Scorsese couldn't get Silence made. He tried 20 years and he had to go hustle money from India to make it happen. Now he's hustling Netflix, but that's a whole other conversation. Netflix just keeps giving him off $200 million to de-age Robert De Niro. Oh, yeah. Jesus. But that's the thing. They always have to hustle and it never stops. It never stops for anybody, no matter who you are. You still got to go do it. But at the level that we're talking about, which is the indie level, you definitely can't hustle. You can't stop that hustle. No, without question.
Business is business. You know, what company have you ever worked for or know out there that you don't have to put in an 8-hour day? Or you know what? Even if you have a regular corporate job, you're still working 8 hours a day. What? It's just, you know, as indie filmmakers, it's like we're still putting in 8 to 10 to 12 hour days of work, right?
Exactly. Now, how big a part I'm assuming before physical media was, you know, DVDs and Blu-rays, and that was a much bigger deal 4 or 5 years ago. What part does it play still to this day?
What I haven't put out a whole lot, like a new film in the last 3 years. So, you know, I don't have what a new product would do, but I just know from a library of stuff, absolutely DVDs have dropped off. However, you know, DVDs are still selling on a weekly basis from I've now kind of moved from WordPress to Shopify. So Shopify site is kind of our main platform now, and then Amazon, but absolutely dropped off, but you know, they're still selling on a weekly basis. Physical items like, you know, t-shirts and bundles, you know, do well as they're marketed, you know, just from the kind of set it and forget it standpoint. You know, when you put effort into it, people making it aware that it exists, whether it be Facebook retargeting on Facebook ads or an email drop with, you know, 10% off or something, then yeah, they move. But again, it's effort. You're selling your products.
Right. Exactly. And physical products, I know, depending on the physical product, will still do well. And DVD, people keep saying, oh, it's dead. It's not dead. It's not dead. It's still making money, man. I know guys were making a lot of money, but it depends on the niche. Depends on who it is, where it is. Some places in the world, still DVD is the thing still. Netflix still does the DVD by mail thing. Nobody likes
really?
They don't like to talk about it, but it is still a thing. Redbox is huge.
I still outside of front of my grocery store, I see people in front of the Redbox. So
it's still going. And if you could get a Redbox deal, oh my God, those things are we could talk offline. I could tell you the numbers. Oh my God. It's insane. Best distribution deal on the planet right now, if you can get it, if a good Redbox deal. But anyway, we'll talk about that later. but yeah, like I saw some like special wood covered DVD editions and things like that you're selling for a premium, like at 50 bones, but that's something that the collector wants.
Right. Yeah. That goes back to Ride the Divide. We did put a bundle together. It was a wood box with a laser engraved sort of top. And then inside was a book and a t-shirt. And dude, this goes, you did some homework.
Hey,
this goes back quite a few years. So, and we did sort of a live thing with a fan, you know, a few weeks ago, and he was, you know, there kind of, you know, talking, and on his bookshelf behind him was one of those boxes like from 2010. I'm like, holy crap, dude, you saved that. He's like, no, dude, it's of course.
it's a wooden case for a DVD. What am I going to do? Throw it away?
And I'll walk into bike shops and whatnot. And there's, you know, one of my posters, you know, sitting up in a corner somewhere, you know, in a bike shop. And you know, we've shipped out probably 6,000 posters over the last 10 years between all the films. Yeah.
And that's, I'm assuming a good profit margin on those things.
Some of them were profit, and then some of them just happened to be, you know, as we, like you mentioned earlier, when we went into a city for a theatrical event, I sent posters to all of the bike shops in that particular city with a letter and everything else, just to, you know, build buzz and everything else. So it's, and then with some Kickstarter campaigns and bundles and things like that. Any posters.
Right. And the thing is too, like thinking about it, because I've been in bike shops. I have a bike. I'm not anywhere near what you guys do, but I ride. Not to divide, I just ride. that hobby is expensive. And bike riders spend money. Like, it's not just buying a $200 bike. You're talking about, I've seen bikes at $6,000-$7,000. It's like, right. And they're very passionate about riding. So they will spend money. So as a niche audience to provide products for, this is not a bad one to pick.
No, you're absolutely right. And it is interesting. So I helped produce another documentary called Here I Go Again, which was sort of about, you know, kind of like where are they now from an 80s, you know, hair metal band. And what was interesting is, like, I think I got spoiled exactly what you just described. Here's this upper middle class demographic with cycling. And then we were pushing out this Here I Go Again documentary with, you know, a different sort of niche. And man, it did okay, but man, it wasn't doing what I got spoiled, you know, doing with the cycling projects.
Right. And people always ask me, like, how do you make money with independent filmmakers? Everyone's broke. I'm like, well, you know, it's just about providing a service and things like that. But a lot of people come into the game trying to try to just grab money and try to take advantage of filmmakers and things like that. And I feel that filmmakers are the most abused demographic of an audience ever. And it starts with film school. Like, it starts with paying obscene amounts of money for film school, which you're not going to get an ROI on for a decade if you're one of the lucky ones that can actually make a career out of it in film school. So it's, I feel that they're just constantly being abused and abused. Gosh, and abused.
And then even like the film festival, it's like, it's the please choose me industry. It's like, please choose me, please choose me. It's like, yeah, we've been,
No,
that's a whole other topic.
Right. And the whole please choose me. And I think what you've been doing for a long time, and what I talk about in my book and what I've been doing a long time, is to take control. Stop asking for permission. Start building out your own system. Start building out your own infrastructure so you can make a living doing this.
Can I get an amen?
Preach, brother, preach. Now, so I see that you use Vimeo, and it was VHX prior to that, before Vimeo bought them, for sales of your own TVOD. Do you, and I saw that, if I'm making it wrong, some of them are on iTunes, or all of them are on iTunes and all the major TVOD platforms as well?
Correct. Yeah. And you know, even though, yeah, as you know, I put as much effort into as much as I can control, I then, you know, as many places as I can get it from a traditional standpoint with iTunes and Amazon On Demand and things like that. Absolutely. And, you know, I know people are like, what's the best platform for my film? It's like, there isn't a best platform. It's like, any platform you can get on is the right platform to be on. So
if you can drive traffic, it's all about driving traffic. But I was going to ask you, what part is TVOD doing well for you? Because I've been saying for a while now that TVOD, unless you can drive traffic, is pretty much dead for the independent filmmaker. If you could drive traffic, there's still some hope. But they've just stopped. And I know probably back when these were released, TVOD was still a thing. People were still renting, but they don't rent as much anymore because everyone's just got used to that whole subscription model. Like, I pay $10 a month. I expect to get all these movies eventually.
That's exactly right. No, we've been, yeah, Netflix has kind of ruined it, you know, going back a couple years ago, and even more so now. But again, it's like, you've got to keep at it. As many places as you can get, then freaking do it. And, you know, yeah, things have dropped off, but, you know, there's still sales happening on Vimeo on demand. There's still sales on iTunes. There's still sales on Amazon on demand. There's still, you know, every place the film is placed is generating some revenue.
So, still to this day on all these films.
Yeah, it's, you know, granted they're old now, so it's not tens of thousands of dollars a month, but it's absolutely on a daily basis, like you said with your book, on a daily basis, the films are being sold somewhere.
And that adds up, you know, and if something you created 10 years ago is still making you money, and a lot of it obviously is passive even,
right?
Because it's just out there in the ecosystem.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. That's a win-win, and it's not going right to a distributor somewhere who's smoking a cigar and going ha 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 ha, like, you know, that image of that cigar, that distributor. It's actually money's going to you, and you are controlling that revenue stream because you decided to self-distribute. And also, I was going to ask you, how dense is this market for movies, like documentaries about bike riding? Because I haven't seen a tremendous amount of them in my travels.
Not in the cycling world. You know, I think there's so much free content up on YouTube from cycling and you know, that the extreme stuff, and you know, like Red Bull is kind of got the market on the extreme side of things, which, you know, they put a ton of stuff out for free. But, you know, with this ultra endurance type stuff that I've put out there, it's, you know, there isn't that much out there. And I've got the mentality of, you know, this is premium content. This is a premium story. It's got, you know, great music and tremendous emotion built into this storytelling. It's a professionally packaged film, and there's really no place you can watch the film, you know, for free, unless of course it's on a TV network or something like that, where there's, you know, advertising on it or something like that. So pretty much every place my films are either rental or are transactional in nature.
And you haven't gone into the AVOD world or SVOD world?
Some of them have ended up there. I'm super intrigued by the AVOD type stuff. And that's, I'm almost worked what I'm working on right now, again, with the whole, you know, screw the gatekeepers. It's like, I'm actually working on building out my own bikepacking media company.
As you should.
It's almost kind of merging, you know, Netflix and masterclass.com for bikepackers. So it's going to be video content and how to content and, you know, on our own apps and web browsers.
After we get off the air, I can guide you in this process.
I've been down that. So the last month I've been doing tons of demos and chatting with folks, and the deeper I go into it, the more my mind is absolutely being blown. So.
Oh yeah, we could talk. I could definitely give you some whatever advice I could give you. I've done sure. A little bit of it. So, and I saw another product that you created, which is why I talk about in the book, educational products. Educational products are so powerful because they tap into an emotion, a need of something that the audience really wants to learn about, and it's when you can tap into emotion of an audience member or a customer, that's when you can really make a difference in their life. So. Something like, which was your educational product called Bike Packing Secrets, which was sold for like $80 about how to bike pack properly with all these stars. And it's like 10 hours, something ridiculous like that. And I looked at that. I'm like, oh God, he gets it so well. Oh my God. That's all digital. So there's no packing because you're not packing 10 hours of DVDs.
Exactly right. Yep.
And it did well.
It did do well it was stuff that we would put on the DVD extras, you know, how to, you know, bike pack and how, you know, the gear and whatnot. So then it was, you know, people, again, I mentioned, you know, Netflix is ruining it because people expect it, you know, to be free with their subscription. So the thesis was, you know, people are more willing to pay for information than they are content. So that's kind of where that came from. Let's actually package, you know, incredible how-to information. What became masterclass.com? So this was, you know, perhaps the precursor to when masterclass.com kind of started doing their thing. And then, you know, bundled it up and put a website together and marketed it from a strategy standpoint, put ad dollars behind it. And you're right. What my production costs were probably $2,000 to actually go shoot this how-to content, whereas, so it cost nothing to shoot and create. And there was not a whole lot of editing involved. But then, you know, the payoff is the strategy. Now the strategy about how to package and marketing and putting it out into your audience.
Right. And you're feeding the audience what something that they really want. You're giving them that. And it's an audience that you've already gathered them. You're like, you love my movies. I know you like bike riding and bike packing. Here's a course on how to do it properly. Here's a t-shirt because you want to represent. Here's a cool poster for your wall. And then you just start adding different product lines, different things. What other ancillary product lines did you create? Like, I mean, I'm assuming sweatshirts and t-shirts. What other things did you put together?
T-shirts, sweatshirts, posters, DVDs, Blu-rays were the bulk of it. And then just some unique little one-off items here and there. Like we took a bunch of titanium bike tubing and chopped it up into sections and put a USB drive. So you've got a titanium bike tubing USB drive with a 4K version of the film. So, so I guess that's the bulk of it, and you know, nothing too, you know, absolutely crazy. And then from the t-shirt side of things, you know, we use our own printer, but then also some print on demand type stuff, which, you know, did okay, but not great. So I guess that's as crazy as we got.
But then you'd be, of course, selling credits, educational products, all these other, these are all revenue streams. These are all
for sure.
These all the, and then you use also Kickstarter to kind of get things going for each of these projects.
Yeah. So, yep, exactly. So the Inspired to Ride film was made. So the Kickstarter for Inspired to Ride, which went back to 2017, was to kind of kickstart the world premiere. And the hook was, what if I could invite the entire world to this world premiere? So we had the, you know, the athletes kind of come to Denver, Colorado. And again, back to the how-to type content before the film. For 3 or 4 hours earlier that day, we put on sort of a summit. So I kind of had a film festival mentality. It's like when you go to a film festival, you attend panels and you kind of have discussions about, you know, different topics. So we kind of had sort of how to summit type things going on throughout the day before the film in the theater. But then we, again, the whole inviting the world. So we sold tickets to people around the world who could attend. And this was before live streaming became, you know, was a thing. I think YouTube Live, you know, just started later in 2017. So we were kind of, again, cobbling together live events, live streaming events. And we had actually like 40, you know, people from 40 different countries bought a ticket and tuned in to kind of the summit that we put on. And then when the film screened, we did utilize VHX. So when the film screened, everyone got their email around the world to watch the film. And then at the end of the film, they could tune back into our live stream to watch the Q&A and everything after. And that did really well, actually.
Yeah. And a lot of times filmmakers underestimate the international market. A lot. Everyone here in the States only think about, oh, it's just the US, maybe Canada, maybe the UK, but they generally just focus on the US. And yes, the US is a very large market. It's probably one of the largest markets. I think it still is the largest market in the world. Take it from someone who's got an international podcast, and sells products, digital products online all the time. International is huge. And there's so many people who, imagine if you're living in Nepal, and I've had it, and they just like, I want to tune in and watch this, like, because there's no way I'll ever get to go to this thing. I can't afford it. It's just at the other side of the world. But for $50 or whatever, $30, I can log in and watch it. That is so powerful.
Absolutely. Yep.
And you're absolutely right. And I'm assuming there's bike riders all over the world.
Absolutely. And yeah, UK is a big market for us. Yeah. Europe and UK in particular has been huge.
Now, did you ever approach any promotional partners to help you market or sell this, like bike shops or bike brands or anything like that?
Some brands, you know, it was, you know, again, you know, difficult to get a lot of brands to say yes. Some brands have said yes, but yeah, I think it's just, you know, a lot like trying to go out and find an investor for your indie film, or again, trying to get into, into a festival or something. Dude, there's still a ton of no's, even though I've kind of got the three films, you know, that have done well. It's like, I can't call up Specialized and you know, say, oh yeah, Mike, we're going to throw you $50,000 for your next project. I still don't have that. And, you know, perhaps I haven't put the same amount of energy into it that I should have, but it's still a struggle. And perhaps, you know, I don't know where we kind of are going with this, but I'm still, you know, the direct to consumer. It's like, I would much rather put my time and energy into, again, using the frame surprise and delight, thousands of people who appreciate, I would much rather try to pre-sale $25,000 worth of my next thing to this audience who I've put the time and energy into than trying, you know, of course, if a sponsor is going to throw me money, great, but it's still a struggle there, you know, to get a yes is difficult.
Yeah. The hustle is real, sir. The hustle is real. You always hustling, man. Always hustling. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. Now we talked a little bit about, you've mentioned it a couple times, RTD 10. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So Ride the Divide had its 10-year anniversary last year. So kind of in the middle of the pandemic, you know, we kind of put a virtual event together to kind of celebrate the 10-year anniversary of the film and brought some OGs in from sort of the Divide bikepacking sort of world and kind of did a cool sort of 3-4 hour, again, sort of interview type thing. And then we watched, you know, kind of the film with a lot of the people, athletes who were part of the original Ride the Divide. And then as part of, again, with bundling, it's like the tickets were $10, but you could also then order, again, to the pre-order, an RTD10 bundle, which was a new version of the RTD10 film with a new poster and new packaging. So we're actually working on that right now, which is going to be, so RTD10 is Ride the Divide's 10-year anniversary box set. And I'm still working on what's going to be inside the box set, but there's only going to be 1,000 of them ever created. So, you know, like the official movie poster will be 1 of 1,000, 2 of 1,000 hand numbered, and then probably some new physical items and t-shirts. And this is where, you know, getting some brands on board. Hey, brands, do you want to, you know, send us 1,000 of something that we could put into this box set bundle? So that's kind of what we're working on.
And what is that going to retail for, just out of curiosity?
It'll probably be $125 for this box set bundle.
So $125 times 1,000. That's not bad, man.
That's pretty good. And then it's a new version of the film. So the film is back in the edit bay. So we're telling the same story, mm-hmm. but anywhere from 25% to 40% of the footage will be different. So potentially new music and new scenes and new stories. Because we ended up with 170 hours of footage from covering the event. So now it's like it's the same story, but you're seeing new unique scenes and awesome. Things that happened, which then I think could really inspire people to like go back and watch the original to see what's different and how it is told different. And then it's also a new film that ends up on iTunes and all the other platforms. So, and we get to go, hopefully pandemic permitting, some live events and back to our whole sort of what we do.
That's amazing, man. Again, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, man, and talking to someone who gets it. Before we finish, I want to ask you a few questions to ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Break into the business. You said the word, the hustle is real, man. It's like hustle, get on the phone, network, make connections. You know, do what you can do. Gosh, dude, and anymore, it's like, again, this freaking iPhone, you know, I'm holding. I just saw that DJI just came out with a brand new freaking drone that, you know, it fits in your hand to go get aerials. It's like, you can go create whatever you want. So, just get out there and do it. Hustle, make.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Man. I don't know. That's a tough one. Gosh, the longest. I don't know. It's, hit the next one. Let's come back to that one.
What are your favorite films of all time?
Freaking Lost Boy.
Just so, you know, good. So good.
Going, it's like, I'm going to date myself, but dude, that came out when I was in college, and it was like a midnight screening of Lost Boys. And God, we were just drunk and, you know, having a crazy time up in the balcony watching Lost Boys. And then, you know, bought the DVD of that film and just watched it over and over and over again.
Can I tell you my Lost Boys story?
Yes, please.
Okay. So first of all, Lost Boys, arguably the coolest vampires of all time. Cinematic vampires, Near Dark, pretty close to it, but they would arguably the coolest looking, just coolest vampires. A buddy of mine was an actor in Lost Boys 2, not the one they made, the direct sequel that didn't get finished. They shot footage, but never finished it. Uh-huh. So this is the story. The story was that you remember when Kiefer Sutherland got impaled, right? Well, mm-hmm. he didn't like blow up or sparkle, or something. Sorry, did you hear the tone in my voice when I said sparkle? You know, he didn't blow up or anything. So he's in like the coroner's office, and they pull the horns out, and he comes back to life. So that's how they were going to start the whole thing, and then all his guys, I think some of his guys actually did blow up, but he didn't. So he just breaks out of the thing, and he just starts grabbing the first people and starts vamping out on them to build up his crew. My buddy was going to be one of those vampires. They shot a bunch of scenes. And then I think a week into it, one of the director walks up to everybody. He's like, announcement, everybody, we're closing down the production because Mr. Sutherland has decided to move on to another project instead. And that was Young. And he went on to do Young Guns. He wanted to go do Young Guns instead of Lost Boys 2. So we never got to see a Lost Boys 2. I don't even know if Joel Schumacher was directing it or not, but that is the story. That is a little tidbit, a little Lost Boys trivia.
That's amazing. I had no freaking clue. And I remember my first time in Santa Cruz going, holy crap, this is Santa Clara, man. This is the bridge that they were hanging from.
All right. Anyways. So the other two.
I don't know. I think Lost Boys, you know, that whole discussion covered, you know, number two and number three as well.
Fair enough. And do you want to go back to that other question or just let it go?
Say it again. Rephrase it.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Dude, I think I've always had the mentality of, you know, don't burn your bridges.
Yeah.
And I think that's just... you know, holds so true. And of course I've probably burned, you know, a bridge or two, in my time, but man, I think that is, don't burn your bridges.
You know,
I
had a running gag with a lot of the guys I used to work with who were working in my VFX company. And they'd be like, Alex, you don't nuke bridges. You don't burn bridges. You nuke bridges. I'm like, yeah, it's a thing. And when you're younger, you do things like that. But as you get older, you start realizing how small this business really is. And from someone who talks to people on a daily basis, interviews and stuff, I'll talk like, look, you know, Kia, I know Kia. There's like, and it's, if you and I just met, oh, I know Kia. You know, it's and if I screwed Kia over, or you screwed, you see what I mean? It's such a small business, and that's something that filmmakers really need to understand. They think it's huge. It is not. It is very, very small. Even these big guys who I talk to sometimes on the show, who are very established filmmakers and big, you know, big making $200 million movies, they'll start talking about like, oh, this guy connected me. I'm like, oh, really? He connected that other guy too. And oh, he's like, it's just fascinating how small the business is, and it gets smaller on a daily basis. It's pretty great. So that's great advice. Don't burn your bridges. Now, Mike, it's been a pleasure talking to you, brother. Where can people find you and everything that you're doing?
Probably, you know, the easiest, gosh, I don't, you know, MikeDion.com is a freaking really old website. I haven't updated it forever, but there's some contact information in there. The new project, RTD10.com. is a place to kind of go. That website will evolve and change as the project kind of goes through its evolution over the next three to six months. If you want to check out sort of the Shopify site, inspiredtoride.it is that site's done, you know, incredible amounts of revenue from that site. So if you want to see a site that's kind of one of those direct to consumer sites that's actually generated some great revenue, you could check inspiredtoride.it out. Mm-hmm. Hit me up on LinkedIn if you want to talk biz.
That's great. And I'll put those links in the show notes. Mike, man, thank you again for coming on the show, man. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to someone who gets it, who's been doing it. You're an OG in the filmtrepreneur space, sir. So I appreciate that.
Appreciate your time.
I want to thank Mike for coming on the show and not only dropping his knowledge bombs, but providing inspiration to filmmakers around the world that it can be done. You can sustain yourself as a filmmaker doing what you love to do. Thank you so much, Mike. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/464. And if you haven't already, head over to filmbizbook.com and pick up a copy of Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business. It has become a Amazon number one bestseller and continues to surprise me how many books that we continue to sell day in, day out, month in, month out. It's pretty, pretty inspirational. So please pick that book up. It will definitely change the way you make films. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.